wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. If I was a baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
Are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 24th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick concludes his three-part interview with China expert Richard Smith. They discuss China's economic drivers resulting in overproduction and its impacts on the planet. We'll post links to parts 1 and 2 along with part 3 later this week on our website. Following the recent death of friend and comrade Todd Sloan, we'll spend the second half of our show looking back at the contributions Todd made to social justice organizing through his work and practice in critical psychology. Todd Sloan was a frequent contributor to The Old Mole on the Psychology and Politics series with Jan Hawken. Jan joins me for this memorial tribute. I am Denise Morris for The Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting KBOO and programs like The Old Mole Variety Hour. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Richard Smith.
Hi, Richard Smith. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. Nice to be back. Thank you.
Richard Smith is a China expert, teaches, writes a great deal in the U.S. press, the left press, for the last 25 years. Today is the third part of a three-part interview I've been doing with Richard. In the first two parts, we discussed how China developed so fast, and whether they could keep going, in fact, challenge the U.S. for international leadership. Richard was clear that while they faced daunting political and economic problems, they would certainly continue in their effort, and they would surely attempt to keep their growth going and also bring much of the global South and South Asia into their orbit. But even if they do, and the struggle for power in the world continues, climate change is going to intensify and lead to crisis. Richard Smith is writing a book about that, almost finished. The title is Chinese Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse. Is that right? Is that the title now, Richard?
That's the title of an article I wrote in 2015, which is the takeoff of this book. The book's title is China's Engine of Ecological Apocalypse, and that'll be published by Verso next year.
Richard, tell us about what the Chinese leadership is promising, and then we can discuss whether we can take comfort in their promises. That is, what are they doing?
Okay. Last October, a year ago, at the 19th Communist Party Congress, Xi Jinping gave a big lecture to people and talked a lot about China's desire to transition to an ecological civilization. And he talked about the things that China had done. It, in fact, done several important things. For example, they banned imports of waste plastic and electronic trash to China. They forced the shutdown of coal-powered power plants and steel plants and so forth around Beijing last winter to suppress the smog. They've done a range of things like this, but it's not solving their environmental crisis, which is huge. Let me just give you a statistic about this. I'm talking about global warming now, global heating. In 1992, China's carbon emissions were just half the level of those of the United States. In 13 years, from 1992 to 2005, China's emissions doubled to overtake those of the United States. Then, in just 11 years after that, from 2006 to 2017, China's emissions doubled again. China's emissions are now twice as the level of those of the United States, more than the U.S., EU, Japan combined, and yet China's GDP is only 63% as large as the U.S. What's more, U.S. emissions have actually been falling for a decade, although they turned up just a little bit this year, while China's emissions have been relentlessly growing for an average of about 5% for decades. And this year, China's emissions increased this year at about 4.7%. And we're talking 4.7% increase in emissions in the second largest economy in the world, like a $12-13 trillion economy. So that's a huge increase in augmentation in emissions. The increase alone is greater than much of the emissions in Europe. So it's a really shocking increase, and scientists are just completely freaking out. When I wrote that first article that you mentioned, China's Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse, for Real World Economics Review in 2015, I asked the question, why is it that China's pollution is so much worse than the pollution in normal capitalist countries like the U.S. or Europe or Japan or even Taiwan? Not just CO2 emissions, but water pollution, soil pollution, and smog, and toxic contamination of food. You've probably heard about all the scandals they have about toxic food in China. You know, so much food is toxic that the Chinese regularly strip the shelves of every place from New Zealand to the Netherlands. People go overseas and they just buy all this stuff and bring it back because the Chinese are so desperately afraid of eating their own food. So why is this? And I asked it because, you know, China has a ruthless police state, a totalitarian police state. You would think that a police state would be able to suppress pollution. Another part of that question was, why is it that the Communist Party is not able to discipline its own cadre, its own officials who run these industries that are so polluting all over the country? And so this was the introduction to the article, and it's also the introduction to my book, Why is China So Different in This Respect? But so out of all, they have many, many problems, but the worst right now, the most dire for the whole world, is the surging CO2 emissions. So the question is, what's driving those? China's drivers are not capitalist drivers. First of all, the state needs to industrialize itself. It wants to build up all its own industry, its own steel industry, auto industry, airplane industry, everything, the electronics. Chinese government wants to create an entirely, largely, as much as they can, self-sufficient industrial complex that they produce everything they need and they export. Mao wanted to have a country of self-reliance, self-sufficiency. Well, Xi Jinping, from Deng to Xi Jinping, they want a country that is self-sufficient plus exports. They want to not be dependent on the world market any more than they have to be because they're a state-based ruling class. They're not a ruling class that's invested in the whole world market. They don't own shares of companies all over the world. Of course, some Chinese capitalists do, and lots of communist cadres do too on the side. But the state itself, the state industry, the state economy is based in China overwhelmingly. Of course, they've bought companies in the West like Pirelli Tires and Syngenta Pharmaceuticals and Smith Pork Producer in America. They bought all these companies. The state government owns lots of private capitalist companies in the world, and those operate more or less like regular capitalist companies, but the basic state industrial structure is geared to developing the Chinese state. So that's the first thing. They have a tremendous need to drive that industrialization. So that means a huge amount of overproduction that nobody particularly needs in the world market, but that they find it in their interest to make. Secondly, jobs. In capitalism, if they've got overproduction, you just lay the workers off, and that's the workers' problem. Good luck, buddy. Go out and find another job. In China, the Chinese Communist Party was originally a workers' party back in the 1920s. Not after the 20s, but in the 20s it was. From that day, the Chinese Communist Party has claimed its legitimacy as the representative of the Chinese working class. So it cannot ignore the workers completely, even though it's very brutal to them, very cruel to them. But it cannot ignore them completely because it doesn't want to have masses of unemployed Chinese workers milling about, rioting and protesting that they don't have jobs. So the Communist Party finds it in its interest to keep those workers working, even if they're building, producing steel they can't sell, or empty apartments that nobody wants, or shipping stuff overseas and so forth. They have to sell at below market prices. It's rational then for them to do so. Thirdly, 1989, since the uprising in the democracy movement there, they have found it in their interest to maximize consumerism. So in China, the government does its best to promote consumerism. They want people's mind on consuming and tourism and all this kind of stuff, and not on politics. So the government has wasted staggering amounts of money to produce all this consumer junk that is just trash like we have here, you know, that they should not have done in the first place. But that's what they do. And so, you know, you see, you know, all of the countries littered with glass bridges and tourist stuff, consumer crap everywhere in the cities. They have their own plastic mountains they can't get rid of now. You know, they stop importing our plastic because they make so much plastic junk there. They don't know how to handle it themselves. So they don't need ours, too. So they've stopped importing our trash. But the biggest problem is CO2 emissions. In order to keep this engine of growth going, to keep these workers working, to keep building those industries that China wants to build, it aspires to build its 2025 program where it will have all its own self-sufficient indigenous innovation and high tech and in electric cars and cloud computing. In order to build all of that, not to mention its police state apparatus of spy cameras. This country is blanketed with spy cameras everywhere. Iris readers and fingerprint readers and palm readers and just everywhere you go. You've got a subway, you know, in many places. And not to mention the whole state, the whole province of Xinjiang is just a lockdown police state. I mean, a lockdown prison, you know, the whole place. Everybody's completely, you know, there's a million people in actual prisons, and then the whole rest of the population is not much better off. If you read the accounts of what's going on there, you know, police blockades every few blocks, and it's a gulag state. Xinjiang. That's what the Chinese government has created there. In order to keep all this going, they need a hell lot of electricity. And they produce most of their electricity in China by coal. One of the things they are most well known for is they have produced huge amount of renewable energy, solar panels and wind power. China is the world's leading producer of solar panels and wind turbines. Not only that, but it has the largest installed capacity of wind and of solar. And yet, those account for a trivial share of electricity generation in China, about 3%. There's about 8% or 10% energy produced by hydroelectric power. But the rest is produced by mostly coal. Trying to get off that a little bit and shift to natural gas. That has its own problem. They have a growth machine, which I argue in books is even more powerful than capitalism at this historical juncture. And it has been. China has been basically in great leap forward mode since 1949. They have been in an all-out mode under Mao. We want to catch up and surpass Britain. We want to surpass Britain and catch up with the United States. That was Mao's driving goal. And under Deng Xiaoping, we were going to be a prosperous, wealthy nation. And under Xi Jinping, we want to rejuvenate China, return it to its deserved place in the world as the center of the world. It's all about wealth and power. It has been for Chinese nationalists from the Communist Party all the way back to mid-19th century. This has been the driving ambition of China's ruling class. And it is the driving ambition of the Chinese Communist Party, for sure, because for sure it ain't socialism. The point is that they need to produce all this stuff, and they need to keep the economy in top gear. And to do that, they need a lot of electricity, and the way to do that is produce coal. So the Chinese find themselves in a position where they are the largest consumer of coal on the planet. They consume as much coal as the rest of the planet does altogether. And they have built a lot of renewable energy, that's true. But they're building new coal-fired power plants almost as fast as they are building new renewable energy plants. So, you know, you see these headlines in the West about, oh, China's renewable energy is growing by leaps and bounds. It went up 17% last year or 20% the year before. That's true, but it's from a tiny, tiny base. The coal production is only going up maybe 5%, but it's from a huge, huge base. So the net result is that the increase in electricity production each year, more of it is produced by coal than produced by solar and wind, way more. So the consequence for China is most immediately a lot of smog. They're trying to shift to natural gas. To transition to natural gas is very hard. You need pipelines and infrastructure, a lot of it, and it's expensive and it takes time to build. So to transition big cities like 15 or 20 cities in northern China from coal to natural gas is not going to be done in a single year or two or three. And then it requires buying natural gas from overseas, which the Chinese are trying to be as self-sufficient as possible. Again, as I said, especially now with the trade war, the U.S., is a major exporter of natural gas. Of course, the U.S. wants them to buy it. So, you know, to make a good show of effort here that you're coming around to some trade agreement with the U.S. Point is, it's not going to solve the CO2 emissions problem. And that is really the huge problem we're up against, because China's emissions are so huge that China's emissions are enough to tip the world into collapse, regardless of what America does or Europe does. Their emissions are more than twice the United States. And there is no popular movement in China to suppress these, because it's a police state. You can't you stick your nose out and you try to protest and you get arrested. People can't protest this. And people don't even know about the emissions because it's a totally state-controlled press. And so people don't know what they're doing to the planet with these emissions. They know about the smog, and there have been protests about the smog. And the government is trying to get off coal in the key cities so that they can reduce the demands from the population to clean up the air. In principle, you can do that. I mean, I live in New York City. New York City used to be covered in smog in the 1950s and 60s until they transitioned to natural gas and oil, which are much cleaner burning than coal. So it can be done. It doesn't solve the CO2 emissions crisis, though, but it does solve the smog problem a lot. In many ways, transitioning to natural gas would be better. But solar and wind is very difficult for the Chinese to adapt, because it's very difficult in Germany, where they have a huge amount of wind power. It's difficult because you need a very high-tech grid to distribute the power. You need backup power for when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow. China doesn't have that. It's a very parcelized economy. That is, it's a very fragmented economy, always has been from the beginning. And the consequence of that is that you have the multiplicity of little grids, local grids, and they're not connected to the national grid. There is no national grid. They're just all these local grids. The local bureaucrats have an interest in building stuff they don't need because they get subsidies from the government. So local bureaucrats will build, for example, an electric car factory when they have no chance really of making a successful go of it, because they basically just want the subsidies from the central government to build that electric car plant. In America, we have two electric car companies, three. In China, you know how many electric car companies there are? There are over 500 of them.
500?
They're all over the place. 500. It's so crazy. It's because China is a parcelized economy in which the only way local bureaucrats can take advantage of new opportunities is to do it themselves. Local bureaucrats in, say, Sichuan province don't invest in industries in Shanghai or Shenzhen as a rule. They don't. The government says, well, we want to subsidize renewable energy. Well, the only way that they can profit from that is if they build the renewable energy themselves. And so you find local officials building windmills or solar panels, whether they need it or not, or whether they have any use for them or not. They just want to get the subsidies from the government because that's money for them, and they can peel off some of the money from them for their limousines, their mistresses, and their fancy houses and so forth, and their Rolex watches. And they find it in their interest to build stuff all over China. They built this huge wind turbine farm out in the Gobi Desert. And it was supposed to power some city that they built. It was a ghost city and never did anything. So they built this huge plant out there. It's this big plant that the windmills just spin in the air and get battered by sandstorms from the Gobi Desert because it's not connected to anything. So some local officials got paid a lot of subsidies to build this plant. It's not connected to anything. Even when they're connected, they don't necessarily run very much because local officials have an interest in buying locally in their province. And if their local province has power plants and coal, then it wants to buy from them. It doesn't want to pay for expensive wind-generated electricity 500 miles away in some other province. So the consequence for huge what they call curtailment, wind power and solar power, it just doesn't get used. It gets built and not connected, or it gets connected but not used, or not used very much. And so they have all these wind power plants all over the country and solar power plants that are not really used very much. So local officials find it more rational just to build coal-fired power plants, because there's coal everywhere in China mostly, and they can build those power plants and they can run them 24/7, and they don't have to worry about supplies. They don't have to worry about the wind or the sun. There's a long way around planning that China has built a huge amount of solar power and wind power, but they don't use it very much for electricity production. This is a big problem for them. ¶¶
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Richard Smith, a China expert. His upcoming book is, Richard, give us the title again.
China's Engine of Ecological Apocalypse.
The world is moving towards climate crisis. There's no question about it. Neither the capitalists of the West nor the bureaucrats of China, they want to maintain their systems. They are not ready to reconstruct their energy systems, their industrial systems, their agricultural systems, all the rest of it that uses fossil fuels. And China exorbitantly, a little bit more efficiently in the West, but still they're not stopping, and they're showing no signs of stopping, and they seem to think that maybe geoengineering can bail them out. New technologies will appear. They're confident the Earth is heating. We don't really have that much time, maybe 20 years, maybe 40 years, but indeed things are going more quickly than any of the scientists predicted. I mean, the worst-case scenarios seem to be coming. At some point, there's going to be a huge crisis. One thing China can do is industrialize and maybe reindustrialize. At some point, there's going to be a some kind of international body set up that is from all of the major polluting countries like the U.S. and China, and maybe India will join that club soon, and the U.K., probably only about 10 countries would be involved. They're going to have to change themselves very, very radically. It's not inconceivable that the Chinese expertise in very rapid industrialization coupled with the U.S. expertise in certain kinds of energy efficiency and grid building, and especially local grid building, that probably will be necessary because huge grids are extremely expensive and also prone to failure in the great storms that we're going to be experiencing. Could Chinese, their rapid industrialization, could that in fact be some kind of model for rapid state-developed and state-directed mobilization to build up a new economy, to change agriculture, to change transport in particular? It seems to me that's the only hope. Could China actually offer something when that time comes?
I don't know, Bill. It's all very speculative. I mean, I know this sounds completely crazy, but the best thing for the planet would be if the Chinese economy collapses to doing nothing. I argue in the end of my book and in my article that China needs to shut down massive amounts of industry, all these overproducing industries and so forth. Everything that's designed to be obsolete needs to be abolished, basically. It just has to be completely abolished, including cars. That is, new cars. And we need cars, but we don't need new cars every year, millions and millions of new cars every year. That is an industry designed to destroy the planet. And those industries just have to be shut down in China and in the United States. China is the largest producer of automobiles in the world. That whole industry just has to be shut down. Many industries, construction industry is just, China is completely overbuilt. It doesn't need any more construction, any more new freeways, any more new high-speed rail. They need to shut down massive amounts of industries in China. And I've said the same thing for the United States, so I'm not picking on China here. But China's industries are particularly a problem here because they're so huge and there's nothing stopping them. You know, in the U.S., when you can't sell something, you stop producing it. Not in China. When they can't sell something, they don't care. They keep producing it. And that's a really huge problem. So China has many, many industries, not to mention the coal industry. They need to basically just close the coal industry down, period. Well, that's a huge problem for China because it powers the whole country. But it powers all this industry that they don't need and the whole planet doesn't need, all these empty apartment buildings that nobody needs, all this overproduction across the board. They need to basically shut down almost all the coal-fired power plants, just enough to keep the lights on and force a transition to renewables, create a completely different kind of economy that's built for what the Chinese need, not for profit for the state industries and the private industries. So that's an immense problem. I just don't see how that could possibly happen short of an entire collapse of the Chinese ruling class, which is basically the China class of the economy, and a revolution. It's just not going to happen short of a revolution. It's probably not going to happen short of a revolution in the West either. I mean, I'm not ruling out a peaceful transition to eco-socialism. You can never say never, you know. But problem with the overdeveloped, you might say, north of the planet, the industrialized world, is that we just produce too much stuff, overproducing everything across the planet. That all consumes resources, and it all produces CO2 emissions. And the only way to stop it is to stop it. You just got to stop it. You just have to shut down all kinds of polluting industries around the world. And as it happens, a lot of those are in China. A lot of the worst industries are in China because a lot of the worst industries from the West, from America and Europe, migrated to China because there were no bans on pollution and so forth, and they had cheap labor. Mostly because there were no bans on pollution, so the filthiest industries moved to China, the smokestack industries. So they've got the biggest chemical industry in the world today. But the American capitalist economy, the global capitalist economy, is designed to constantly produce new stuff, invent new stuff you don't need. That's the capitalist logic. In China, it's different logic. It's even worse there in some ways. But it's the same kind of thing, that you have massive overproduction. We live on a finite planet, Bill. We can't just keep mowing down the forest and strip mining the ocean to get resources to produce crap that we don't need. This has just got to come to us. Just a complete stop.
That's for sure. But it would be good to be able to have a source of energy that was clean, that could provide sufficient mechanized energy for mechanized food processing, or keeping medicines cold, or a variety of things
that
we need. Right now we have sufficient kind of renewable energy.
No, but like Mark Jacobson at Stanford, you know, he laid out how the U.S. and the whole world could transition to renewable energy.
Very rapidly.
Yeah, like in a couple decades.
It wouldn't even be that expensive.
We estimated it'd be between 8 and, I think, what do you say, 8 and 11 trillion, something like that. You know, it's doable.
It's all doable. It may well be that some of the Chinese techniques and creating wind turbines and solar panels, they're in the lead on that stuff in the world. It may be that some of that will be useful in a future when we've stopped producing all of this junk. When we stop doing all of those things, still there's going to be a lot of people on Earth who need food. We have to move very rapidly to some kind of energy form, as well as different agriculture.
And when I talk about deindustrializing the North, I'm not at all saying the whole world, because, you know, like hundreds of millions of people in India don't even have electricity. So they do need some industrialization, of course. But many underdeveloped places in the world need some industrialization, but not capitalist industrialization. That's the point.
KBOO Radio, 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Richard Smith, a China expert. His upcoming book is, Richard, give us the title again.
China's Engine of Ecological Apocalypse.
Richard, very good talking to you. Looking forward to your book. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Thanks to Bill Resnick and Richard Smith for that very informative three-part series on China. We'll be posting all three parts on our webpage, Old Mole Variety Hour. KBOO.FM, Old Mole Variety Hour. The music that you just heard is called Ambush. That's by a Chinese traditional group. And Ambush from Ten Sides is considered a masterpiece in Chinese classical music. A good find and an interesting history. Just go ahead and Google that, Ambush, and you can dig around on your own. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning, and Joe Clement is our engineer. In the last half of our program this morning, we'll be looking back at the contributions of our friend and comrade Todd Sloan. And we'll be looking at the contributions specifically that he made to our program and to social justice organizing. He was a frequent contributor to the Old Mole on the Psychology and Politics series with Jan Hocken, and Jan joins me for this memorial tribute.
Todd Sloan, professor of psychology, author, and activist, and a dear friend, died last week from pancreatic cancer. Todd was a frequent contributor to the Old Mole and a guiding force behind a number of social justice projects in Portland and internationally. His books include Life Choices, Understanding Dilemmas and Decisions, Damaged Life, The Crisis of the Modern Psyche, and Critical Psychology, Voices for Change. Todd and I shared a love for left traditions in psychology, including feminist psychoanalysis and critical psychology, and we tried to enlist these theories to think through psychological dilemmas in social movements. Before he died on December 17th, Todd had recently returned from a conference in Chile on community psychology and social transformation, and another conference in New York City on psychology and capitalism. Todd's activism began with anti-nuclear and Central American solidarity work in the 1980s, then Green Party organizing in the 1990s, and anti-war organizing post 9/11. After moving to Portland in 2004, he worked with local sustainability projects, Triumph Life Community Farm and Transition Portland, as well as the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. Todd was a co-founder of the Social Justice Action Center, which grew from his vision of creating spaces where activists could reflect on their work and experiment with collective practices, forms of prefigurative politics, ways of realizing or practicing a vision of the world that can't yet be fully realized. He was known for dialogue methods he brought to social justice projects and what he termed, quote, supporting activists for the long haul.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken toll, we ducked inside the doorways, thunder went crashing. As majestic bells of bolts struck shadows in the sounds, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight, and for each and every underdog soldier in the night, and we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Over the past few years, Todd Sloan made regular contributions to the Old Mole. Todd, along with Jan Hocken, developed the Psychology and Politics series covering a range of topics, including psychology and activism, psychology, torture, and the military, leftist psychology, emotion, envy, and inequality, and a review of the Netflix series House of Cards. Jan and I read now from dialogues over this past year following the election of Trump and the surge of activism in the U.S. This brief exchange speaks to the underlying principles in Todd's work, supporting activists for the long haul.
Mass movements like the struggles of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, second wave feminism, and anti-war movements of the 1970s bring groups together in ways that stir possibilities for radical social change, but they also generate their own anxieties. Sometimes periods of mobilization stir hope, but they can also set people up for disappointment. You've written about supporting activists for the long haul. What do you think is required?
There is a sort of community practice, a way of getting the work done among left activists that is passed from generation to generation. But this knowledge is not transmitted easily. Each individual has to learn firsthand how to be part of a political community. When we have larger or broader movements, different communities of practice clash. For example, some activists bring business models, others non-profit organizations, others non-hierarchical anarchist collective model, etc. Group conveners need to spend plenty of time helping a group know how it will process issues, make decisions, authorize action. And we should not be surprised or frightened when these communities of practice collide.
Well, how do we think then about the shifting emotional states of activism in a period of high hopes for mass mobilization, like the period we're living in now, when an intense climate of fear brings possibilities for radical change as well? There can be a bipolar aspect to activism.
There is a roller coaster in a complicated mess of feelings to sort out: anger, fear, despair, solidarity, courage, hopelessness, betrayal, guilt. What I worry about most is the post-anger and post-mobilization phase, in which there is still as much work to be done, but it is not as exciting, not as motivating. Movements require a lot of work to sustain themselves, and not all of that work is exciting. But there is pleasure in the daily work of movements as well. It's important to be deeply committed to dialogue, to be as fully dialogical as possible with good facilitation, so everyone feels heard and is actually heard. And sometimes managing the disturbing feelings that arise in groups can't be addressed by the group. Groups need to acknowledge their limits and what is to be done outside the primary group. That's why I have been forming activist support groups, forms of self-care, buddy systems, and mentoring relationships.
Melted furnace. Unexpectedly we watched, with faces hidden as the walls were tightening, as the echo of the wedding bells before the blowing rain dissolved into the bells of the lightning, tolling for the rebel, tolling for the rake, tolling for the luckless, they are abandoned and forsake. Tolling for the outcast, burning constantly at stake. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
From a blog posted earlier this year, Todd describes his interest in the psychology of coloniality, an area of political psychology and critical theory that Todd took up before his death. He'd been particularly influenced by the work of Anibal Quijano, a Peruvian sociologist who developed the concept of coloniality. Quijano also died this year. Here is from Todd's blog post. Quote, "My studies continue to be exciting and a bit depressing. The history of European oppression and violence over the last 500 years is hard to wrap one's mind around for lots of reasons. How can people treat other humans so horribly? What is the source of this incredible greed shown by the Spaniards and English in particular? How did the former English colonies that became the United States take up this horrible role in the global scene? Slavery of Africans, genocide of Native Americans, imperialistic wars, and interventions in countries and governments around the world. I'm just trying to put together more pieces of the puzzle than I've had a chance to before, given that my focus was on personality theory and not on history.
Through the mad, mystic hammering of the wild, ripping hail, the sky cracked its palms in naked wonder at the clinging of the church bells, blew far into the breeze, leaving only bells of lightning and its thunder. Striking for the gentle, striking for the kind, striking for the guardians and protectors of the mind. And the poet and the painter far behind his rightful time. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Last summer, Todd was having dinner with my partner and me, and we got to talking about depression and left politics. Both Todd and I, as critical psychologists, were not too keen on psychiatric diagnoses. We had a fondness for old 19th century terms for madness. Terms like idéfixé, monomania, neurasthenia, and melancholia. There's actually been a robust revival of interest in melancholia in cultural studies, some drawing on Freud's work, Mourning and Melancholia. Todd described himself as more melancholic than depressive, because melancholia means that you have experienced forms of goodness, taken in what we psychoanalysts call the good objects, but that you continue to suffer from losses that have been hard to get over. Melancholics are trying to recuperate the lost good objects amidst the bad in the world. Melancholia is a condition of longing, of striving, and I think for Todd, his revolutionary spirit carried that note of melancholic sadness into the struggle. Todd played a song for us that night titled Reflections of My Life. He'd been working out the chords on the song for some time, and he explained that this song expresses quite profoundly the state of melancholia in reflecting on the life of this dear friend and comrade, Todd Sloan. I would like to play that song now.
Sunlight to moonlight, reflections of my life. Oh, how they fill my eyes. The greetings of people in trouble, reflections of my life. Thank you.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, KBOO FM 90.7. We're spending some time this morning memorializing our friend and comrade Todd Sloan, who died on December 17th. We miss him, and we'd like to continue to share his contributions. Let me first say that I personally met Todd in 2004 when he first moved to Portland, and my first thought was, you know, who is this quiet man with such a great speaking voice? We really need to get him on the Old Mole, and I mean that. It did take a little bit of time to get him settled in to the idea of coming on the radio, but he eventually became an important voice for socialist struggle through his work in critical psychology. Now, we'd like to turn to a piece that he did on psychology and activism. It was Psychological Effects of Oppression. Todd Sloan.
Welcome to another episode in our ongoing series on the psychology of activism. Organizers working for social justice often wonder why people who are sufficiently informed about issues that affect them in major ways do not immediately act and work for social change. There are, of course, many obstacles like lack of time, need for childcare, work schedules, lack of understanding of social movements, and so forth. Because of these things, many of us limit our activism to sending a check, signing a petition, or clicking like on Facebook and hoping that such acts will pile up and make a difference. There are, however, what might be called psychological obstacles to action, and these are more complicated than simple fear of retaliation or laziness or procrastination. These psychological obstacles are embedded in our character structures and defense mechanisms as a result of experiencing domination, oppression, marginalization, and exclusion. This means it should be fruitful to turn to psychoanalysis, the science of unconscious psychological processes. We could ask, for example, what can psychoanalysts tell us about the ways in which we are shaped psychologically by the various forms of oppression that we experience as we are growing up and living out in our adult lives? And how would understanding these effects of oppression inform practices such as consciousness raising, community organizing, and mobilization efforts for social and environmental justice? These questions were actually the topic of a workshop at a recent meeting of the Association for the Psychoanalysis of Culture and Society at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Most of the participants in the workshop were psychotherapists or psychoanalysts with a few academics in the human sciences. I personally found the discussion especially relevant to our efforts as organizers struggling to mobilize people to participate in progressive social movements, so I share some general conclusions here. First of all, by oppression, we had in mind constraints and subjection that people experience as members of a group due to marginalization, exclusion, discrimination, structural violence, such as poverty, and direct violence. This would include, of course, sexism, racism, homophobia, classism, as well as ableism, ageism, and other less recognized forms of oppression. How do these experiences of oppression leave their traces in the structure and functioning of the psyche? We usually tend to gloss over the complexities here with simple references to, for example, trauma or complexes, or abstract terms like alienation or marginalization. We also tend to lump together all sorts of oppression and violence and domination. These are obviously not the same. But to illustrate what the workshop discussed, we'll focus on oppression related to classism, in particular the ways in which the psyche is shaped by experiences of class oppression, rendering workers less capable of recognizing exploitation at work and less likely to join with others to change working conditions, for example, by having the courage to unionize or to go on strike. This is obviously not a case of blockage due to a one-time traumatic experience, although there may be exemplary experiences of violence in individual lives, such as bullying or parental abuse, that might be organized along class lines. The effects of classism over one's life settle into clusters of memories and experiences that generate interpretations of oneself in relation to powerful or privileged others as inadequate, weak, isolated, different, shameful, humiliated, embarrassed, etc. These experiences might occur at home with authoritarian parents, or at school with teachers prone to shaming less prepared students, or on the playground, or in the neighborhood where many forms of cruelty are practiced, or in the city where differences of wealth are obvious while shopping or just walking around. They could also be related to the media, where lower socioeconomic classes are portrayed in stereotyped ways or are simply absent from most programming. The memories and self-images linked to these experiences coalesce into a generalized psychological stance that is activated when one finds oneself in social scenarios where class position, status, economic power are in play. For example, in a personal meeting with the boss, a meeting of workers with management, a meeting of renters and landlords. In some cases, the psychological stance may lead to resistance, revolt, or sabotage, for example. But what we mostly need to understand better are the stances that get labeled as apathy, passivity, dejection, submission, withdrawal, and bystanding while others experience oppression more directly. How can we best understand these limiting psychological stances? First, we can notice that as a result of experiences of class oppression, the psychic structure may be characterized by things like constraints on imagination and agency, because there are prohibitions on expression, expansiveness, and creativity. There might be rigid identifications with dominant ideas or authority figures, and little freedom for exploration of negative feelings that might develop into a more critical and questioning attitude. There might be self-evaluations that are either idealized or denigrated as inferior, and in general, a lack of congruence between thought, feeling, and action. Second, we should also develop a concept of how the psyche might be structured if these experiences of class or other oppressions were not frequent, pervasive, or eventually powerful as they accumulate over time. One would find instead greater freedom of play between impulses, desires, sensations, and imagination and memories, greater agency and capacity for connection and relationship, congruence of thought, feeling, and action, fuller and more complex meaning-making, deep awareness of and stronger responses to acts of oppression that are occurring in the present. Now, when we turn to what practices of organizing should take into account in light of this, we need to keep in mind that the primary tasks are to enhance a person's capacity to make sense of what is going on, both emotionally and relationally, to articulate experiences, to give voice to their suffering, to feel recognized and heard by others, and to develop trust and solidarity with a group of others who are also affected or acting in alliance with one's group. It's also important to remember, finally, that organizing practices that support the overcoming of psychological effects of oppression go far beyond simple education and information. Ideally, they mobilize the senses and the body through the arts, music, poetry, spirituality, dance, and connection to the rest of nature. They should also be deeply dialogical in order to ensure time to listen and understand what all have been experiencing and to foster visions of better futures. These are the sorts of practices that can address and overcome the psychological effects of oppression. This is Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know, you better run, run, run. But a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Oh no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper.
That's Tracy Chapman talking about a revolution. Todd Sloan was very fond of music, spoke quite a bit with our old mole Tom Becker about music. They were both great lovers of music and poetry and writing and philosophy, all of it. And I want to thank Tom for compiling the music for this tribute this morning. We also heard Reflections on My of My Life by Marmalade, Scottish band, 1968. A very wonderful piece of music as well. Bob Dylan, Chimes of Freedom. Thanks, Tom, for those. I want to also thank Jan Hawken and Joe Clement for helping produce this memorial tribute. I also want to, on behalf of the Old Mole, really the radio collective, I want to make sure that we send out our love and well wishes to the family and friends who made up Todd Sloan's community here in Portland and around the world. Todd, you will certainly be missed. Well, the Old Mole is a collective labor, and we come here every Monday morning at 9 a.m., and we're thankful for our listeners and for our contributors. We want to make sure that folks can help KABU, too. You can go online and donate to KABU that supports this program. And it supports programs like the Old Mole and us volunteers who come on in here, rain or shine sometimes, to do our thing. So we thank you for being out there. I want to let you know, before we sign off, what's coming up this morning on KABU. We have at 10 o'clock, Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein presents excerpts from the recent hearing on the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama. At 11, Making Contact explores the expansion of gender identity and presumed roles in society. At 11:30, it's Voices for the Animals talks to the founder of Earth Fire Institute Sanctuary. Thank you. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris with Joe Clement, our engineer.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time now is just 10 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Columbia Land Trust, conserving and connecting people with the nature of the Northwest. More information, including tours, events, and volunteer opportunities, online at columbialandtrust.org. And now, stay tuned for Locus Focus. Happy holidays from the KBOO community to all KBOO listeners today. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032.